Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis from scorching hot Upper Westchester, New York. And I am excited because we have Michael Shushko here, the author of one of my picks for 2017, Shifting Sands. A family all in the Marines, and yet each one vying for the top spot as they quarrel, dispute, and even argue when together. Two young men are sent on a mission, but the end result is sabotage, and they wind up dead. Someone is out to compromise Iran's national security, and a group of Americans was sent to audit their facilities to learn whether they are producing weapons of mass destruction. I'm not going to tell you anymore because Michael Shushko is here. Good morning. How are you today?
Good, Fran. How are you?
Hanging in there, staying cool in the air conditioning, not coming outside. So, explain, how did you decide on creating the first scene in this book, the two men who were set up, and deciding what happened?
Well,
that's what got me.
Sure. Well, I wanted to set up the book with the very first scene, and this was the theft of the nuclear material that could be used to make a bomb. And it actually highlights the fact that someone's been stealing nuclear material from the plant for some time. The scene suggests who they believe those responsible for the theft is, but it also sets up the book and the intrigue that goes on throughout the book on who's stealing this nuclear material and leaking nuclear information from the nuclear plant.
Yeah, it is. It's like, wow. So explain the family dynamics. Then we're going to meet the Shane family. Explain the family dynamics. And when we meet them, they don't like each other. How come? There's a lot of friction there.
There is. It probably comes from three brothers all in the Marines. The older two are officers in the Marines. Mark, the helicopter pilot, and Nick, who started his career in the enlisted ranks, now works in special operations. They're a year apart, Joel is the youngest. He's a sergeant. He's 10 years younger than his brothers. And he's a specialist in Middle East and Middle Eastern affairs, and he speaks Persian Farsi. Mark and Nick used to be close, but, you know, years in the military and in combat can do a lot of things to an individual. And unfortunately, it hardened Nick. Over the years, the two brothers just kind of grew apart. There's no one specific event that started the friction. It's just Nick and his PTSD and bitterness just made it very difficult for the two brothers to get along. He's a little resentful of staff officers and pilots and anyone that's not like him, a combat Marine. Probably been made a little bit worse since promotions have been slower for him because of his personality, his abrasive personality, whereas his brother Mark, who hadn't yet been in combat, had sailed through his promotion. Both of them are very protective, however, the younger brother Joel. And that is also a source of friction because Nick and Mark, as kind of two surrogate fathers for their younger brother, both have different thoughts on how Joel should live his life.
Isn't that sometimes the way it is in every single family, sometimes not just in the Army? So why were the Americans stopped and not allowed to go? They were supposed to do inspections to make sure there were no nuclear weapons. How come they were stopped, and what red flags go up to let them know that there's something they're hiding?
Well, the UN International Atomic Energy Agency sent inspection teams. They do this quite frequently to check on nations that are suspected of having nuclear weapons research programs. So this team was actually led by a Frenchman, and they actually compromised their team by leaving the Americans behind at the insistence of the Iranian government. As we all know, the Iranian government and the U.S. government have been at odds for quite some time. So the Iranian government kind of suspected that the Americans were spying on them because the UN inspection teams have been getting more and more specific information about their nuclear weapons program that was going on in the Iranian plant. So because of that, the Iranian government felt suspicious of the team if they had Americans on there, so it kind of forced them to stay behind. The director of the nuclear power plant, Mohsen, was removed by the newly installed military director because of the attack and the theft of the nuclear material that we talked about in the first question. He was brought in, the head of this new military head was brought in to find the leak and how this material is being leaked out of Pabdan.
So we have Colonel Mustafa Sabri, did not like this guy at all, and he ordered the Americans to leave and go packing and not come back, and orders that the man formerly in charge be taken into custody. So how did you decide to create that? And if they're supposed to have these inspectors, how come he was allowed to tell them to get out? That's even scarier, because they came in to do their job and they didn't let them, and then they took them in custody. How come?
Right. So the Iranian government first agreed to allow the team to come in, but after that, the theft of the nuclear material the night before, things changed quite rapidly on the scene at the power plant. This military colonel was brought in to kind of figure out how this material was stolen and where this leak was coming from. Happened to coincide with the time that the inspectors were coming in, and the last thing this colonel wanted was a team of UN inspectors snooping around the plant when nuclear material was just stolen from there. It very well could have been an international incident. And Sabri, he's a patriotic Iranian. He wanted to protect his country from by preventing these outsiders to learn more about these issues that were going on within the plant.
So why was he afraid that they would have reported? So let's get to our main girl. Within the lab, there's an Iranian physicist named Dr. Let me turn my page. Sarah Kaderi, who is taking a chance and risking her life smuggling intelligence and leaking it to the UN, detailing her deadly work at the nuclear plant. So how did she get away with doing this and not getting caught at first, anyway?
So Dr. Kaderi, she's a nuclear physicist at the plant. She's great. She's very smart, very strong-willed, and she really had visions of actually helping her country. You know, there's been so many wars in the Middle East, and a lot of people think oil is the cause of many of these wars. So she felt that if she can help her country develop more less reliance on fossil fuels and nuclear energy, maybe that will help her country kind of move past those conflicts. However, because of her skill as a nuclear physicist, the government really wanted to use those skills to develop nuclear weapons. So they put her in the basement and put her in charge of this nuclear weapons program. And then she realized quickly that that was the intent of the Iranian government. And it wasn't her goal. And she was smart enough to know the devastation that nuclear weapons can have on the world at large, but specifically how devastating it could be for her country. So that's when she decided to kind of use the only tool she had available, and that's to get this information out to Iran's enemies so they can stop Iran from doing this.
Well, that's hard to stop Iran from doing anything in actuality at times. So why did she choose to become a spy? She decided to, she was taking her life in her hands. So what was she actually working on in this tight security lab? What was the truth behind what she was supposedly doing?
So the plant is actually a nuclear weapons, nuclear power plant. However, they were doing the secret weapons program that she was forced to be in charge of, and she hated her work, and she would drag her feet on her work and delay the project timeline, all the while secretly passing information on the nuclear research program to her Turkmen intermediate, who with the hope of the international community coming, putting force on Iran to stop this nuclear weapons research. It was so important to her that she would was willing to risk her life so that Iran could be safe and free from nuclear weapons.
That's too bad. Tell us more about Nick Shane. I don't like this character. I don't know why. And why he's so opposed to going back to Iran. And then you've got Joel and Mark, and they have different jobs and different roles, and they're going to get intermingled in when they go back. So why doesn't he want to go back and with his troops? What is he afraid is going to happen?
Well, Nick is a great Marine. He's a true warrior.
Like him.
But he's,
I like
him. Yeah, he's been deployed so many times to so many war zones and has seen enough of his men die that he's become, you know, very hardened and bitter. It's cost him his marriage, his relationship with his brother, and maybe even his career in the Marines. He has PTSD, but it's more than that. It's much deeper than that. His views of the world have become soured and polarized after serving in so many years in the Middle East, in the war-torn Middle East. He, more than most, actually understands the ramifications of what would happen if war breaks out in Iran, especially for the American ground troops that would be involved. He understands the dangers and how many American lives would be lost. And in his view, the lives of his Marines are precious to him, and he just didn't see anything in Iran worth fighting for, in his opinion. So that's why he just felt it wasn't worth the lives of his men.
Well, you can understand that. What happens, you know, this is an interesting situation here. You bring them all together for the mother's birthday, and it's supposed to be a happy occasion. So what escalates their animosity towards each other?
Well, the
birthday celebration.
Right. Now, Mark and Nick hadn't seen much of each other because they just had kind of grown apart over the past decade or so. Nick had just returned from his tour in Lebanon, which was kind of highlighted toward the end of the first book, Vector. And he had just returned, and he hadn't seen Mark in a while or Joel. And he's close to Joel, and he's proud of his brother Joel. And Mark wanted Joel to kind of better himself and get a college education and talking about his career. And Nick, it just kind of the last straw that broke the camel's back. And Nick and Mark just were at odds over advising their younger brother on how to live his life. And that was really just, that was, as I mentioned, the straw that broke the camel's back, because for years the two brothers had just, they had such different career paths. You know, Nick was an infantry warrior. Mark was a traditional officer in the Marines that hadn't been in combat, but he had been promoted well, and he was a straight-laced officer, and they just didn't see eye to eye. And you know, Nick probably had a little bit of resentment because, yeah, he goes to war and his men die, and maybe he blames some higher up brass in the military for that. And it just kind of their personalities have become so diverse over the past couple of years.
Well, next question is, each one realizes that the war is heating up and they have to be deployed. Why and how do they decide what their missions are? Who decides where they're going to go? And I know that a lot of them didn't want to go, and they, you know, protested even going. But Nick had no choice, and Mark had no choice. So who decided that they had to go? And how did they decide where they would go and what they were going to do?
Well, Nick is a senior major, and as I mentioned, he really hadn't had any – excuse me, Mark is a senior major. He hadn't had any combat experience. But he needs to promote in the Marine Corps, and he needs to take jobs in units that go to war if he wanted to become a colonel or a lieutenant colonel in the next rank. So he chose to come down to Camp Lejeune, which is one of the three major areas where Marines deploy from, because that was kind of the next stage in his career. Nick, he goes back to Lejeune because that's where the special operations unit that he has been in for so many years resides, and those are his people. That's the combat arm of the Marine Corps. And so they both get stationed there, and then that the base has a large unit, and that unit goes to war. It's just their rotation where it's their turn to go to Afghanistan, and a special MAGTAF is what the unit's created. So they each go to Camp Lejeune for different reasons, but then it's the rotation time now for Camp Lejeune to send a large unit, a large-scale unit of Marines to Afghanistan. So really it's Joel that goes at first, and him being a Farsi speaker, they do speak some dialects of Farsi in Afghanistan. So he's going, and that really makes Nick want to go to kind of look after his baby brother.
Well, that did help to a point. So let's get back to Sarah. I really like this character. She's about to meet her contact and takes a chance because, you know, they're going to try to kill anybody that goes against what they want to do. So why did this rug dealer help her pass information? And how did she get away with not getting, you know, found out? Well, at first not getting found out.
In any oppressive society, you're going to have groups, especially the groups that are treated the worst, they're going to form an underground. And the Turkmen and the Kurds in Iran, they're very oppressed by the Iranian regime and the government in Tehran. So there are a fair number of groups in Iran that are secretly working to against the Iranian regime. So knowing that Tehran's ability to make and produce nuclear weapons would create instability in the region, and that the international community would come down hard on them, Nizar, who's this rug dealer that you mentioned, he works with Sarah because he knows Sarah's in the power plant to help pass this information on to the U.S. and the U.N. So he's kind of the intermediary because he opposes the oppressive Iranian government so much because they've done so many oppressive things against the Turkmen and the Kurds in Iran that he hates them. And he works with Sarah to help get this information out, hoping that the international community would pressure Tehran and maybe even help help the government in Iran to change. You know, Sarah, as I mentioned, knows the deadly effects of these weapons. And the difference is now Israel is a threat of war with Israel is actually very real. If Israel knew that or suspected that Iran was developing nuclear weapons, it's very likely that Israel would go there and bomb some of those sites. It wouldn't be the first time. And so Sarah wants to prevent that war as well. So if she can get this information out to the UN, to the U.S., maybe it can put enough pressure on the Iranian government to stop.
That would be a miracle even today.
Yeah.
Tell us about this bad guy. I'm supposed to have a bad guy, people. Tell us about Zealot, the drug lord behind wanting to profit from nuclear weapons, because a lot of it is about profit, money, and greed. Drugs, arms, and sex trafficking. What happens when he learns he has competition? And none of these drug lords want competition, now do they?
They don't. And Salik Murad, he's a top mafia kingpin in Istanbul. You know, for years, he's been running all the organized crime operations in the region, for the most part unopposed. But as these Kurdish groups that are in Iran and in Turkey, as they're banding together in Turkey, some of them actually turn to organized crime as a way of funding their political and sometimes even militant activities against local and national governments. So Salik sees these groups, these rebel groups forming that are turning to his illegal activities and draining his profits. His profits are diminishing because he now has competition. So he doesn't like that, and he's fighting, striking out against them.
So let's ask one more. I'm going to skip the next question and go to this one and then put the next one in after. Silic wants to run the operative working with the United States gone. And the PJAC eliminated, but there is much more, as we get to know, the character Steve, who learns that about the United Islamic Caliphate. So how does the United Islamic Caliphate come into play, and how does this make things more complicated and dangerous? Because now we have two other characters, Steve Connors and Karen Brenner. They're working to get Dr. Kadari over to the United States, but first they have to get the intel she prepared while working in the nuclear plant. So how did they come into it, and how does Selleck find out about this Servan and want him out of the way?
All right. So Servan is the head of one of these Kurdish rebel groups that we mentioned, and he's supplementing his income by embezzling and by smuggling things in and out of Iran and other places. So he's a freedom fighter in his mind for Kurdish resistance, but he's also part of the underground, and he is one of Selleck's growing competitors, and Selleck wants him eliminated. Selleck wants him gone. And Servan, of course, he wants Selleck gone. And Servan, he has inroads with the Kurds and the Turkmen in Iran, and he works with Nizar, the rug merchant. So he's getting this information from Nizar from Sarah Kadari on Iranian nuclear ambitions and nuclear weapons research. So he's passing this to the U.S., to Karen Brenner, Steve Connors is the CIA agent, also from, he's the troubleshooter that we met in Vector. And Karen Brenner is a CIA analyst. And together, they're working with Servan to get this information about what's going on in the Iranian nuclear weapons research program.
So they want to get her over here, but we're not going to give too much away about that. So who are the other players in this, and what about the ambassador? What role does he play, the ambassador play?
So Ambassador Calacona is the U.S. representative to the U.N. Security Council. She is a very savvy senior U.S. diplomat, and she knows that Israel is just chomping at the bit to bomb these suspected weapon sites in Iran. Iran is developing weapons, and Russia and China may secretly be helping. She wants to avoid another war. The U.S. has been in so many wars in the Middle East over the past 15 years, and she knows how bad another war would be in the Middle East that would drag the U.S. in. So, but she can't stop it. She's trying, but she needs Russia and China to support her on the U.N. Security Council against Iran, and that's a very difficult thing to do. So she dispatches Karen Brenner at the CIA to find out what's going on and get her proof that Iran is actually doing this. And with that proof, she hopes she can get Russia and China to jump on board and help her stop the war.
That's hard too with Russia and China, especially what you're reading about in the news now with Russia.
Yeah.
So tell us more about the Islamic Caliphate. Oh God, they're horrible. And they hate for everyone except those who believe in their ideology. And that's at the heart of so many things that are happening within the last month or so, even more.
Right.
So why are they like that? And why don't they hate everyone that doesn't believe in whatever they believe in? And why do they want to kill everybody off, which is really scary?
Yeah, the United Islamic Caliphate, or I abbreviate as UIC, the new terrorist group created by Abdullah al-Harbi. He's a Yemeni who was once high up in al-Qaeda. Al-Harbi was disenfranchised with al-Qaeda because he felt that al-Qaeda had lost its focus and has lost its ability to win the ideological war against the United States and the West. So he kind of broke off and created his own company or his own organization to spread his Islamic fundamentalist ideology. And that's not uncommon. ISIS was once closely aligned with al-Qaeda, but the two are now enemies. As a matter of fact, in many areas, ISIS and al-Qaeda actually fight each other. But unlike ISIS or al-Qaeda, you'll see over the next couple of books in the series, The UIC has a very different approach to spreading their radical views throughout the world. Now, their goal is to create a unified Islamic world under one caliphate or one caliph, one leader, and one Islamic rule under strict Islamic laws. And El-Harbi's approach is a very different approach than you see with ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and it very well may be successful where these other terrorist groups have failed.
Oh, God. So when Siobhan realizes that Saliq is heading him up and smuggling, what does he do? How does he try to stop him? Because he's a hard guy to stop.
He is, because Saliq has been so well established for so long in Turkey. He's got a lot of powerful Turkish allies and a lot of powerful Iranian allies. Siobhan is a Kurd, and he's new to the organized crime scene. And that's why he turns to the U.S. and the U.N. to try to get some big players to back him in his battle against not just Iran, but his survival in Turkey with Saliq trying to get him eliminated. So Saliq is trying to use all of his resources to get rid of his competition in Siobhan. And Siobhan is really just trying to stay alive while at the same time supporting his Kurdish movement in Iran and trying to bring down the Iranian government. So he turns to the U.S. To try to help him.
How come we always get involved in everything? We just didn't ask that question, but how come we always get involved in everything? It just seems that no matter what happens, the United States gets involved in just about every war. Why is that?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of, there are elements in the U.S. government that are elected from time to time that feel it's our duty and feel, we have a moral obligation to help other nations that may be struggling, that may be not be democratic, that may be oppressive. And I think we probably see that a lot more than now than in the past, where a lot less isolationist than we used to be. And interestingly, in the Tradecraft series, the book kind of discusses that. The book series discusses that, how some of these major international organizations use the U.S. always, for want of a better word, sticks its nose in places throughout the globe, and some of these organizations actually use that to their advantage.
I don't know how the troops feel about getting involved in every single thing that goes on. I know my nephew did three tours in Afghanistan, and we had to pray each day that he was coming back alive. And my other nephew was in Iraq for a while. It's horrible.
Right, and that's actually right, and that's what drives Nick. Nick has seen this so much, and he's tired of it.
Yeah.
He doesn't see anything in these places that's worth the lives of his Marine. And that's where the shifting sands, and I know that's where the shifting sands comes in. That's where the shift is. And, Nick changes his views. Mark changes his views. Sarah changes her views on the world based on their interaction.
So tell us about what goes on behind, this was interesting, behind Haban and the nuclear power plant in Iran. And how true to life is that? Because that was interesting. I couldn't, that part of the book I kept reading, oh, my God, that's what's going on there? Oh, my God, how did they get in there? So how did you create that, the nuclear power plant? People, it's not real. He just, made it up. And how did you create what goes on behind closed doors in that lab?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of suspicion that Iran has been developing nuclear weapons, and this comes from scientists that have left the country. It comes from media outlets reporting from various sources that Iran might be developing nuclear weapons, or at least have a nuclear weapons research program. And so I researched a lot of that, and yeah, I have a science background, so I'm always interested in science topics and studying about how easy, really, it is to, relatively easy, to create nuclear material that can be used for weapons. So weapons-grade uranium and plutonium, it can be a byproduct of normal nuclear power plants. So having a research program in a nuclear power plant is not far-fetched at all, because the raw product and the byproduct of an energy-producing power plant can be used and manipulated to be weapons-grade.
Oh, God. So let's get to Colonel Tony Marino, Martino, and he and Nick talk about the latest threat and what has to be done. And Nick knows that he has to go there. He doesn't really want to. So why does he consider even they send him there for a suicide mission? And what exactly is a suicide mission?
But Tony Marino is Martino is a seasoned Army Green Beret colonel, and he commands the Joint Special Operations Task Force that's operating in Western Afghanistan. These task forces take special operations units from all over the armed forces and the military and put them together and work missions. Well, Nick is real happy to be back with the Marine Special Operations Commander, MARSOC, which Martino is in charge of all of it. But as I mentioned, he's not thrilled at all about the prospect of going to Afghanistan, really only because Joel is going. Nick decides he's willing to go to make sure he keeps an eye on his little brother, his baby brother. But he's a very experienced operator, and the mission to rescue, the mission that Colonel Martino puts in front of them, it is a suicide mission, and Nick is experienced enough to know that. He's not happy about it. He voices his concern. He talks about why it's dangerous and why it's not worth the lives of his men. But he's a good Marine. He's a good soldier, and he voices his opinion, but he obeys his orders, and he goes on the mission. He's proven right, as we find out later on, but there were consequences from that.
So Major Mark Shane, Captain Nick Shane, and Sergeant Joel Shane report for duty, as they're told. They have no choice. Several other officers were there, and in order to complete the mission, rules have to be broken. Certain protocols in place, and Joel would handle intel, Nick part of the MARSOC raiders, and Mark one of the best officers around. So how does this play out? Because it doesn't exactly play out the way they want it.
No, and there's an important scene in the book where for the first time since they were in Afghanistan, all three brothers happened to be with their respective units in a big operations center as they're discussing an important mission that's going to happen. And, you know, Mark is an experienced pilot, but he doesn't have a lot of combat experience. So as Mark is explaining his role in this mission, you know, Nick realizes that there can be some risks associated with Mark's plan. And, you know, that causes some conflict between the two brothers. You know, Mark is embarrassed and concerned about Nick questioning his role in this mission. And Joel hears it, and Joel's just fed up. Joel's tired of his two older brothers fighting left and right, and he vocalizes this. I mean, he basically washes his hands of his brothers because of the constant bickering between the two.
Well,
that's a pivotal part.
Yeah, I know. Too much of this stuff can cause people to get killed, too, if they're not focused on what they're doing, too.
Much so, yeah.
So who is General Wiley? Tell us about him and what part he plays, this particular general. Because not all generals play the right part in every single incident.
Right. Well, Marcus Wiley is the Marine Brigadier General, and he's the commander of all the U.S. military forces operating in the region in Herat, and he's responsible for the operations in that area. He has to balance the competing priorities of maintaining stability in Western Afghanistan with all the other missions that the CIA and other people throw at him. So when he learns that this special operations mission failed, he has to make a decision. Is there enough evidence to determine if anybody was survived, and should a rescue mission be attempted, or does he have to just cut his losses and not risk any more of his troops or any of the political fallout from sending people into Iran, and just kind of say this mission failed, let's move on. So that's a tough decision for any commander, let alone a general. And because he has to keep the peace in Afghanistan, he has to protect his troops, and he has to be wary of the political ramifications of every decision he makes, and not prevent and to prevent international incidents. So it's a tough call, and he plays a pivotal role trying to balance all that.
It's almost as if I felt like I was living a mission at times, and I felt like this is what the soldiers really go through. The troops that get sent over, it must be frightening to them in general just to go there and not know what's going to happen at times, too. That's scary.
There's a lot of reality in the book.
But we're not going to tell too many people. Before I forget, I don't want to forget, on Wednesday we have Tara Sue Atcherberg, Practicing Normal, about a dysfunctional family, and boy, are they dysfunctional and scary, and that's really good. On the 20th, we have Amber Brock, A Fine Imitation, and on the 29th, we have a book that is so hilarious, I wasn't sure when I got it. It's called Penny by Peter Davidson, and the penny's telling the story. It's the last ever minted penny that was minted on October 22nd, 1982, the last one actually that has more copper in it. And then, as the penny would say, the rest of them are puny and old and not worth it. So those three shows are coming up, and then I'm taking the rest of the month off of July, and I'll be back on August 1st with 66 Metro with an author from France. And that's what I'm up to. And, of course, Father's Day is Sunday. Today's Monday. Go on Amazon and buy a couple of million copies of Shifting Sands by Michael Shusko. Whether you get Duplicity, get Enemy of the Good by Matthew Palmer, which is fantastic. You would like that book. It's absolutely amazing. And 66 Metro by Bruce Kerwin. And those are what's coming up. Okay, so next question. They had to extract Sarah. How did they go about doing that to extract her? And what happens when she and Nick, what happens to her? What do they think it happens to she and to Sarah and Nick? Because we don't want to tell them too much about it.
Sure. This is where Nick's experience really comes into play, because the original mission, as it was designed, by less experienced on the ground folks than Nick, may not have been successful at all. So Nick has to improvise, and he has to find a way of getting into a very difficult situation and very heavily fortified area, and extract this Iranian nuclear scientist who Iran obviously wants to very much protect. So he has a small team of Marine Raiders, Marine MARSOC special operators, and he goes in and improvises his way in, and although there are some collateral damage, and there's some the battles tend it's a little devastating to the team. In the long run, Nick's approach was successful.
So who are the other players? We have to be Cameron and Gunny. How do they play into this? I like Cameron, by the way, even though he's on the right side, but I liked him.
Well, and that's part of what motivates me, because, I don't believe there are countries that are all good and countries that are all bad. We're all people, and people motivated by taking care of their families and doing what they believe in, and Kamran is Iranian, and he's an intelligence officer, but he believes in his government, and he's trying to find this nuclear material that was stolen from Havdan. Unlike Colonel Sabri, who is at the power plant and preventing anything else from being stolen and finding out who's leaking material, Kamran is out of Iran trying to find out where this material went, and he's going after the UIC to figure out if they have this material, and he goes down to Dubai to try to find out who's stole the material and who's trying to buy it. And there he encounters Steve Connors, our CIA agent, and they actually team up to try to work together as the UIC tries to get this material. Jerome Moore, he's probably Nick's only friend. They've known each other for years, and he's one of the few people that, because he's very similar to Nick and in his military experience and background in special operations, he understands Nick, and he's one of the few people that can actually get close to him. He's fiercely loyal to Nick and dedicated to his friend, and he's a skilled MARSOC raider, just like Nick. And he will stop at nothing to help his friend.
So when, before writing this book, and from your experience in military intelligence, what research did you have to do to help readers understand the gravity of nuclear weapons and what they can do?
Well, as a military physician, I have some training in radiation health and occupational medicine. We deal with radiation health all the time. And I've also consulted with colleagues. I did a lot of research in the scientific journals on nuclear proliferation. Shifting sands isn't as science-driven as Vector, but there certainly are, there certainly is a fair amount of physics weaved into the storyline. And there are also some medical themes just to kind of keep your mind churning.
Mm-hmm. So tell us more about this Colonel Sabri. I really didn't like him. And why he ordered his men to fire upon a helicopter, and why did he want to kill Sarah? That was heart-stopping, let me tell you. Like, oh, my God, is she going to die? Oh, my God, they can't do that to me. They have to bring her back. Oh, how did you create that? That was scary.
Well, Colonel Mustafa Sabri, he's a formidable colonel in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And, you know, the Revolutionary Guard is Iran's premier military unit, and it's called upon to protect the Iranian government from foreign and domestic threats. Sabri, he's an avid desert hunter. He's an experienced and cutthroat soldier, and he believes in his government, and he'll go to all extremes to protect the survival and integrity of Iran. He will stop at nothing to uncover who's behind the intelligence leak and stolen material out of Havdan. And that's why he's willing to silence any threat that what he feels is dangerous and will put his country at risk.
Mm. So we have Mark and Nick and Joel. What happens to Joel that might be the turning point within the dynamics of the family? What changes how they feel about each other?
Well, towards halfway or a little bit past halfway in the book, you know, the brothers finally get back together, and they find themselves in a very, very dangerous situation, and there's some injuries, and the brothers have to learn how to put their differences aside, and if they want to get out of that dangerous situation, they have to work together. They have to forget about these past differences and try to be brothers once again. If they're able to make their way out of Iran and survive. I hope I said that without giving
now,
away too much.
Yeah, that's another favorite character that I have. He plays a minor role, but he's yet very helpful, and that's Jerome. How did he create the skills in this paramedic or EMT that he was trying to save somebody's life? Who is he, and what do we know that we really know? How do we really know that he's more skilled than he thinks he is? Because I like that character.
Yeah, Jerome Moore, he's the gunny that Nick's good friend. And he, which is not at all unlike many special operators, you get a lot of skills. And one of his skills is being a paramedic. And being in combat for many, many years, he's honed that skill. And it's come in handy on many, many occasions. And specifically in this book, he is really saving lives with his skills. And they're truly the unsung heroes, the EMT Corps. And they're on the front lines, and they save lives every day, whether it's in combat or whether it's on, you know, the streets of New York City or in Iowa. And Jerome is, he uses those skills. He's just as skilled with the tourniquet as he is with as he is deadly with a weapon. And he's a good guy. He's very loyal, and the bottom line with him is he does what's right, and he does it always.
So explain one more specific question, then some general questions about writing. Explain the alliance between Steve and Cameron, how they were able to work together, even though basically they really weren't on the same side, but yet they were able to work together. How come?
There, Iran is a nation of predominantly Shiite Muslims. The UIC, like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they're Sunni Muslims, and their goal is to create a united Sunni-based Islamic caliphate throughout the world. There are still quite a bit of Shiite-Sunni friction in many parts of the world today. In shifting sands, the Iranian government is not at all happy to have their weapons-grade nuclear material stolen, and Steve and Kamran find themselves allies of convenience to try to stop the UIC from getting this stolen material. Iran is still a nation, and it would be embarrassing if the world found out that their nuclear material was stolen. They certainly don't want their nuclear material to get in the hands of a Sunni-based radical group, because they may turn on their Shiite brothers in Iran. So Kamran has researched and kind of knows a little bit about the UIC, but he still doesn't know who stole the weapon. Whereas Steve, he's been in Turkey, so he knows a little bit more about that side of what happened. So together, they each have a piece of the puzzle. So they work together to accomplish this mission.
Yeah, I know, and it's amazing that when you have to work together, that you really can if you really put your mind to it. That's amazing. It's too bad we can't do that in real life, that they won't do it. So just right. How involved were the Israelis in this particular incident, and how would you diffuse their anger? Because like you said at the beginning of the top of the show, yeah, Israel, they won't even hesitate to take care of banners. And
right.
Yet they were hoping that they could figure out not to make them take. Israel knows how to take care of things the right way. I mean, if they were in charge of this whole thing, this might have ended a lot sooner. So how were they involved? How involved were the Israelis in this, and how did they decide maybe to convince them not to blow up Iran?
Right. So throughout Shifting Sands, the looming threat of war with Israel is a constant that propels the story forward. You know, the hope for the U.S. is that if the CIA, if Steve and Karen Brenner can get real proof that Iran is developing nuclear weapons, Russia and China would be forced to support any UN Security Council agreement or sanctions against Iran. Remember, Russia and China are both not only permanent members of the UN Security Council, but they're also signers of the International Non-Proliferation Treaty. So they are they have an agreement, an international non-proliferation as a signer of the treaty to back stronger sanctions against Iran if it's determined that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. And if Russia and China is actually helping Iran, well, that could be embarrassing to them if the U.S. has proof that Iran is indeed creating these nuclear weapons. So that's kind of the U.S.'s goal. If they can get this proof, they can hopefully appease Israel enough, because the U.S. doesn't want Israel to bomb Iran, because that would just lead to war. And so the U.S. is kind of the middleman here to try to get Russia and China on their side. Russia and China to calm down Iran and get them to stop doing what they're doing, and maybe the U.S. can work with Israel to defuse the situation so there's no conflict.
So tell us about Iran and Afghanistan and the people living there. Why is it so difficult to create everlasting, you know, lasting peace in both countries, and how did they really feel about us in America?
That's a tough question.
I know. I think the whole world would like the answer to that one.
Yes, that would be a book to write. But, you know, interestingly, there is a significant population in both countries that you mentioned, Iran and Afghanistan, maybe even more in Iran, to be honest with you, of just regular people that have little to no animosity towards Americans. There are Iranians in Iran that love America and love American cultures. But there are also organized entities, whether it's a religious or governmental entity, that try to control their populations by demonizing other groups. If you live in a closed society and you're bombarded with anti-U.S. or anti-Israeli propaganda on a daily basis, and you hear no other information to contradict that, you might start believing it. Even here in the U.S., if the only information you receive about Islam or Israel even is from the media or what you hear on the news, you may not have an accurate portrayal of the large segment of the world's population or the religions in other parts of the world. I found that for the most part, most people that I've met, whether it's New York City or Paris or Baghdad or Sana'a, Yemen, they're good people. They just want to work and make an honest living and take care of their families. Shifting sands, as the name implies, is about changing your distorted views of the world to accurately reflect reality. Nick's views about Iran, Sarah, and even his brother Mark changed as his deep wounds began to heal throughout the book. The same thing happens with Mark's relationship with Nick as he began to understand the terrible things that Nick had been through and what it did to his brother. He could start seeing Nick through a different light. Sarah's polarized view of Americans were changed after she met and got to know Nick. Steve's relationship with Kamran, that changed once they started talking and as you mentioned, started working together. So, yeah, I think if people use their own minds and analyze the situation and gather information and come up with your own conclusion. And get to know people and situations through words and conversations instead of external sources, I think you'll find there are a lot of people. I think people will get along a lot better. Does that make sense?
It does, because people are getting brainwashed into believing what other people want them to, and they don't look past what, you know, you walk down the street in Manhattan, and you see hundreds of thousands of people from different racist countries and whatever, and people are not that open-minded. A lot of people walk away, walk to the other side, give you dirty looks or whatever, and that's sad. Because I think, to me, it's our differences that make us, you know, special and that we can learn from other people. The sad part is that, as in this novel, there's a lot of messages that are conveyed to readers. And one is hate, destruction, fear, weapons, survival, hope, family, disloyalties, loyalties, friendship, and cooperation. And all of those messages come out in this book. But I think the one that comes out the strongest, unfortunately, is hate. How did you create all this novel? I love this book. With all those messages coming out, and how do we get rid of the word hate? Because that's a strong word, which should be eliminated from the dictionary. It's scary.
Yeah. And well, as you suggest, all these feelings and emotions are weaved throughout the story in the book. Probably high up on this list, though, is hope and understanding through just dialogue, through communication, and putting behind, as you mentioned, putting behind you those stereotypes. And I think many problems can be solved by putting down the smartphone and other electronic devices, turning off the TVs, and just have a human-to-human conversation and use that interaction, that human touch, to create your own reality and understanding of the world around you without these external influences that bombard you on a daily basis. And most of them are negative. So, I do think that hate will decrease and hope will increase if people just put all the nonsense behind them and all the external influences behind them and just with open eyes have conversations.
You know, it's funny. I agree with that because I was in Manhattan last year for something, and I'm walking and I'm looking at thousands. I mean, I couldn't even barely walk on the street, and I'm a little person. And I said, my God, there's like hundreds of people here. When you got out of the cab, I said, oh, my God, there's so many people. No one was talking. There must have been hundreds of people on their cell phones walking, not watching where they were going. And the street was so quiet, you could have heard a feather drop with everybody walking. And it's sad because they were using the electronics and no one was communicating. And I guess if people bothered to actually hear what was being said, maybe then we wouldn't be so hateful against other people. Maybe if we bothered to understand everyone, and that's what's really sad, is that I looked at all these people and I'm going, oh, my God, there's now. I had my cell phone in my pocketbook. And I said, you know what, I'm walking, talking to my husband. I'm saying, I'm not going to sit on my phone and watch. As a couple of times, people were crossing the street. I had to yell, be careful, because in Manhattan, you can get killed just walking across the street. So why is that? I mean, how do we get people to just, like, get off your phone, watch where you're going, and just listen, and just look at the world around you and realize that there are a lot of people out there that are not evil. That's scary.
Well, I think we talk to people, we put it in our books, and we hope people read them, and we hope people do the same thing. I hope people read my books with open eyes and make their own interpretations from it. I think the more we tell the story, I think the more people will listen.
Well, I just reposted your review on Facebook so that everybody could read it while I'm doing this, and I'm posting little comments on my Facebook thing. Because of the world and the way it is, I keep my shows private. I'm going to make it public and put it out for everybody to hear because there are people out there that when you do shows like this that make comments that I don't need to listen to. And I only take positive comments or questions about the book. So two final questions. In reality, is it ever going to be able that we could ever stop the Islamic Caliphate or ISIS? Is there ever a way that they could just be stopped or realize that after a while, if you kill everybody that's not in your realm of thinking, there's not going to be anybody left. And what happens if they kill everybody off in the whole universe and there's no one left except them, who are they going to kill off next? I mean, it's sad. It's scary because they don't get to embrace anybody in the world. Is there ever a way to stop them or is that impossible?
Well, you know, in the book, there are a lot of, in the whole series, there's a growing list of impressive protagonists trying just to do that. Steve Connors, Emma Hess, Lee Jansen from the first book, Manny Ortiz, Su Chen, the Shane brothers, Sarah, and more and more will be joined as the series progresses. But one thing I've learned in life, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? So there's no shortage of bad guys as well. But these people are based on people I know. They're you know, real life heroes out there every day, trying to stop this hatred, I believe it'll work. It's not the first time that hatred had been faced in the world and in history, and there have been a lot of success with it, and I think the good people will prevail. May take a while.
So. One final question. What's next for you? When am I getting it? And where can we learn more about you and your work? And everybody, Shifting Sands is one of my top picks for 2017. So you have to read it. And they will because I just put it on my Facebook wall. So what is next for you? Where can we learn about you and your work? And when am I getting the next one? Because I got to know what happens next, seriously. And I've got 50 books inside, but you know what happened? The minute I got yours, I said, oh, my God, I have to read all of these first. And then I picked up your book, and that was the end of me. I just sat and read it.
Well, thanks, Fran. Well, Evil Winds is the next in the Tradecraft series. It's the third. It'll be out in the fall.
Okay.
Since I'll be halfway in the series, it'll be the third of the sixth book. I may take a little break and shift some gears and publish another book in between that's not part of the series. Gardener's Daughter is the name of that book. It's the same genre, but it's a little bit different. But the next in the Tradecraft series, Evil Winds, will be out in fall. And as always, I have my webpage, michaelshusko.com, run by Lindsay Marshall, my publicist, and always Lee Camp, who is my production manager. They take care of all that and do an incredible job, and I can't thank them enough.
They do a fantastic job because so many publicists are so different, and I work with hundreds of them, and it's hard sometimes. But this has been fantastic. I just want everybody to know, I have to pump my own stuff once in a while. My new book, I just have to do the captions, A Daughter's Promise, hopefully will be out next month. My mom was diagnosed in 2003 with dementia Alzheimer's, and I watched her decline. But in watching her decline, I kept a journal of her words. And I started it out in the Vanishing Mind book, but this one is a little bit more poignant. It's told from my voice and my mom's voice. And it talks about how she felt while she was dealing with Alzheimer's and how I made a promise never to put her in a nursing home. And probably it was the hardest promise I ever had to keep, but I did keep it. And it's in her words and my words. And I hope everybody buys it when it comes out. And there are a lot of people that have read it and have given me some fantastic blurbs for it. And anybody out there that wants to read it, I can send you a PDF to give me some blurbs and put you on the front cover of my book. Because this was a work of love and passion, and I promised her I would never do that. And it was hard after 10 years, but she was home when she died. Actually in the hospital, with me standing at her, looking at me, and she's saying, her last words were, no more. And that was scary. So, Michael, I want to thank you a million times. Thank you so much. And I know it's like almost 10 o'clock there. Well, it's only 9 o'clock here in the morning. And whenever you have the next book, please make sure I get it first, please.
You will most certainly get the first one, Fran. And thank you for everything.
Yes, and I will set up another interview whenever you're ready. And actually, I'm glad I'm up at 8 o'clock in the morning. This is fantastic because now I have a whole bunch of books that are staring at me. And because it's so hot outside, all these lucky authors are lucky because I'm not going out in this weather. Thank you so much. I will be back on Wednesday with Kara Sue Asherberg and Practicing Normal and her wacko dysfunctional family. And from America to Japan, have a great day. You have a great night, and bye.
Thank you.